Okay, and just in looking at these papers overall, there's still a lot of talk about PD-L1, perhaps not surprisingly, as in months past. And again, neoplasia remains on top, with very few papers addressing non-neoplastic lung diseases. So if we look first to the articles of notation, for notation, I'd just like to draw your attention to a couple of these that include on page 7. There's a paper entitled "Displaced Cartilage Within Lymph Node Parenchyma in a Novel Biopsy Site Change in Resected Mediastinal Lymph Nodes Following EBUS tBNA." This was published in the American Journal of Surgical Pathology, and I think what amused me somewhat when I read this paper was the number of individuals that collaborated on this work that I thought, how are there so many people interested in something that I've probably ignored 10 million times? The group was comprised of 22 participants from 14 institutions in 5 countries, and this was made possible through the miracle of Twitter. So they actually published a second article on how they accomplished all this through Twitter. So I guess if you have an idea for a paper, you should just tweet it, and maybe other people will be interested in it as well. So I just thought that was amusing, I suppose. On page 8, I'd like to draw your attention to a couple other articles that include diagnostic accuracy of a panel of immunohistochemical. Yes?
So I'm just looking at this paper, but what's the point?
Exactly. That was the point that I was like, my God, I can't believe that there are so many people interested in something that I've ignored 10 million times. So the
to get an AJSP, I guess that's not for us to judge, but I mean,
isn't that amazing?
Wow.
I think it's because it was so many cases that they just got together through Twitter. Like I said, I mean, I guess if you have any idea, you can just tweet it, and other people will want to collaborate.
Got it. Yep. All right.
There's
I'm awake
a.
Now. All right.
What's that?
I said I'm awake now.
Okay. So then there's another paper on page 8 that diagnostic accuracy of a panel of immunohistochemical and molecular markers to distinguish Merkel cell carcinoma from other neuroendocrine carcinomas. This was in Modern Pathology. Not necessarily a lung paper, but I included it just that this problem can sometimes arise in the lung, and this question may come to us. So really just put in here for your reference that this, you know, for future use. Another paper just under that one, the 5 protein-based signature for resected lung squamous cell carcinoma improves the prognostic performance of TNM staging. This was published in Thorax. This was a collaboration between MD Anderson and a Spanish group. And I just found it interesting because they really detail how they went about generating a protein-based classifier to predict survival in patients with squamous cell carcinoma and really showed that this is a complementary, these immunomarkers are complementary to the current TNM system to improve risk stratification. I'm taking a moment now to mention it, just because I wonder, you know, when you see something like this, if this is a hint of what we could expect in the future for risk stratification for patients with squamous cell cancer or other non-small cell lung cancers. So just something, not that you would go out and get any of these immunomarkers and start using them, but something to be aware of. So moving on to our discussion articles, I've picked 4 articles that the first one is a PD-L1 article about on cytology specimens that I thought was relevant, certainly something we're not doing here at Michigan, and I found interesting. The next 2 articles for discussion are basically immunohistochemical studies that I found informative and pertinent. And then the last paper is not exclusively looking at IgG4-related disease in small biopsies, but it's a problem that at least I've been faced with in consult practices and our own in-house cases with, you know, kind of trying to make this diagnosis on small biopsies or the clinicians wanting you to at least. So going from there, the first discussion article is from NYU entitled Assessment of Programmed Death Ligand 1, PD-L1 Immunohistochemical Expression on Cytology Specimens in Non-Small Cell Lung Carcinoma. This is from the American Journal of Clinical Pathology. This is on the theme of doing more with less, which is kind of two of our papers for discussion today. This group wished to evaluate if non-small cell lung carcinoma cytology specimens are reliable for PD-L1 testing by evaluating concordance with paired surgical specimens. So what they did was they first looked into their pathology database for surgical biopsies of non-small cell lung cancer and resection specimens that had already undergone PD-L1 testing. So they weren't repeating that testing. They were just looking for cases on which the testing had already been performed. And then they looked at that group of cases. They wanted to see which of those cases had available concurrent or subsequent cytology specimens. And their criteria was really that there was a cell block and cases with fewer than 50 tumor cells in the cell block were excluded. So that was how they selected their cases. They then went on to stain the cell blocks with the DACO PD-L1 clone 22C3. And then they scored the PD-L1 testing on those cell blocks, and they used a scoring method that was in the same fashion that was used on the surgical specimen. So their reporting is less than 1 is negative. They report a low positive, which is considered 1 to 49%, and high positive of greater than 50%. This was reviewed, the PD-L1 scoring was reviewed by 3 pathologists. 2 reviewed them together and 1 independently. And then they looked at the strength of the agreement between the 3 expression levels between the paired specimens. So the types of specimens that they had, looking at the results, these are really detailed in Table 3, which is very lengthy and includes the patient's sex and age, the types of specimens, the diagnosis, the cellularity on the cell block, and really goes into detail about each case. There were 52 cytology cases with paired surgical specimens overall, but these were from 50 patients. 2 of the patients had multiple specimens. So the types of cancers that they looked at, there were 47 adenocarcinomas, 2 squamous cell carcinomas, 2 poorly differentiated non-small cell lung carcinomas, and 1 sarcomatoid carcinoma. Overall, there was moderate agreement with all specimens. So just looking at everything overall, there was 67% agreement. That's 35 of the 52 cases. Breaking this down and looking at individual types of specimens and cellularity, the highest concordance was seen with samples obtained directly from the lung. There was, that is 83% concordance in those samples. So that includes lung FNA, bronchial brushings, and then direct lung biopsy. There was fair agreement at the other sites sampled, which included lymph nodes and pleural fluid. Of the cytology samples, there was better agreement with the excision samples than the small biopsies. So they were trying to decide how the cytology performed against small biopsies versus resections. And there was better concordance with the excisions that showed 86% concordance versus 61% in the small biopsies. And some of this led the authors to conclude that perhaps intratumoral heterogeneity, which is well known to occur, is the possible cause. Finally, they looked at the concordance between more cellular cell blocks and those with less than 100 tumor cells. So those that had 100 or more tumor cells had moderate agreement, whereas those with less than 100 tumor cells had only slight agreement. So beyond that, they looked at the reasons for discordance. The most common cause was that the cell block was negative when the surgical specimen was positive. That was that occurred in 11 of the 17 cases where there was discordance. Five of the cases, really, you could argue at least there was some expression, and it's really the cutoffs, the difference between a low positive versus a high positive. So they were, you know, sticking to the expression level concordance, so therefore that was viewed as a reason for discordance. And then finally, only one case showed a low positive cytology, but the surgical specimen was negative. It's noted, however, that this was an EBUS lung core biopsy, so this was a small sample which was shown to have less concordance than those resection specimens, so they wondered again about the possibility of intratumoral heterogeneity as the cause for discordance in this case. And finally, of the discordant cases, eight were cytology specimens with less than 100 tumor cells, which we already talked about. So I think that the take-home message here is that cell blocks offer a good option for PD-L1 testing, particularly in the context of a positive expression, which seems reliable when compared to surgical specimens. That is, a negative result does not necessarily mean that the resection would be negative. And then disagreement may be attributable to intratumoral heterogeneity and low cell block cellularity. So as I already mentioned, we're not performing PD-L1 on cell blocks here at the University of Michigan yet, but I wonder, is anyone else doing that, or does anyone have any comments about this paper?
Well, we take these specimens. We just say that it's not validated because it's hard to validate that in the lab. So, so we just put in a disclaimer.
Yep.
We are performing them on cytology specimens now, but most of our cytology specimens are fixed in cytolite to start with, so they're just excluded. So we're doing it on pleural fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, to me, it makes more sense. It makes sense that that would actually be a good sample because it's, you know, getting cells from all over the place in the pleura, and perhaps you're getting a better sample in the end, a better representative sample.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to draw your attention to a paper by Gilbert Bigras from the University of Alberta back in November 2018. He did a study where he looked at the size of the biopsy. And then how it correlated with the resection, and it was a very interesting study. And basically, he looked at samples that were less than 2 millimeters of tumor and greater than 2 millimeters of tumor. Mm-hmm. And he found that if you've got less than 2 millimeters of tumor, you're going to have a lot of false negatives.
Yep.
And you know, he basically discounted this thing of 100 viable cells because that was just. Somebody said, oh, well, we need to look at the percentage of positivity. Let's look at 100 cells. That's how that came about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it bothers me that we're making these decisions on such small biopsies and small numbers of cells.
Right.
Without giving the patient the benefit of the doubt. Maybe if it's negative and it's a small sample and it's less than 2 millimeters, we should be saying, well, it could be a false negative. Take another sample.
Right. And I wonder the number of clinicians that might just still give the drug and see some benefit even, you know, when it's negative. I think that that's a possibility.
Yeah. And then all the trials that are messed up, you know, they do these trials based on numbers of cells and so on. So, yeah.
Yeah, and from what I understand, the cutoffs for the various trials are different. It's just, you know, some of them are greater than one, and then some are that stratification of 50%. So, we aren't very good at being consistent.
No. I think the clinicians think we're much better at doing this than we are. So.
Correct. Anyone else? All right. Well, then let's move on to the second paper that is from out of Japan, and it's entitled Highly Expressed EZH2 in Combination with BAP1 and MTAP. I actually wasn't familiar with this antibody, and so if I'm saying this incorrectly, you know, then someone please correct me. This is the methylthioadenosine phosphorylase, that's MTAP. So BAP1 and MTAP loss, as detected by immunohistochemistry, is useful for differentiating malignant pleural mesothelioma from reactive mesothelial hyperplasia. This was published in Lung Cancer, and this paper really just adds to the literature for methods available or possibly available when faced with this difficult problem of differentiating mesothelioma from reactive hyperplasia. So what this group did or hoped to do was assess the sensitivity and specificity for EZH2 immunohistochemistry for distinguishing malignant pleural mesothelioma from reactive mesothelial hyperplasia, both alone and when used in combination with BAP1 and MTAP immunohistochemistry and FISH P16 deletion. So they looked into their files and they retrieved 38 cases of mesothelioma and 29 cases of reactive hyperplasia. For the mesothelioma cases, these included 27 epithelioid mesotheliomas, 6 biphasic, and 5 sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. And then really simply, they applied the 3 immunostains to all cases and performed FISH on all the cases. For EZH2, this is a nuclear stain that they looked at quantitatively with reporting low and high expression. Low is a 50% cutoff and high is greater than 50%. BAP1 was reported as nuclear staining loss or weaker staining than in control group in 50% of cells. And MTAP, which I already mentioned I wasn't familiar with, is both cytoplasmic and nuclear staining, and it's reported as lost if the staining was weaker than control cells or lost in 50% of cells. So looking at the results, you can look at the results in detail on table 1, which I admit is a little hard to read, at least for me. You kind of have to lead you over with your finger. But I've tried to summarize that here in my summary. So that really gives a detailed look at the sensitivity and specificity of individual markers and when used in combination. So in their hands, all markers showed 100% specificity for mesothelioma. When looking at the individual markers, EZH2 immunohistochemistry was the least sensitive, with 44.7% sensitivity. MTAP was only marginally better with 47.9% sensitivity, and FISH performed the best with 65% sensitivity. So when they looked at these kind of different modalities in combination, they found that EZH2, BAP1, and P16 FISH captured the most cases of mesothelioma with a sensitivity of almost 90%. So they wanted to look in particular at using immunohistochemistry alone, arguing that FISH was less readily available. And so they looked at the combination of the 3 immunohistochemical markers. And those also were very good, quite nearly as good as looking at EZH2, BAP1, and FISH. The combination of 3 markers had a sensitivity of 86%. Now, I was interested to see how this compared to, if you, in their hands, the combination of BAP1 and FISH, which is the most commonly used markers and available, I would argue. And that was 81% sensitive. So the other one is marginally, the other combination of workup and stains marginally improved what is already very good. And then I was also interested out of these combinations to look in particular at what if you were to add EZH2 to BAP1, which is considered probably the most available immunostain. And the addition of EZH2 increases the sensitivity from 52.6% for BAP1 alone to 73.7%. So that's kind of the results of their workup overall. Kind of a minor thing that they just, I suppose, happened to look at, not one of their primary aims of this study. They also just looked at EZH2 expression within the setting of survival. So survival analysis showed that high EZH2 expression, that's greater than 50%, expression in tumor cells was associated with significantly shorter overall survival in patients with epithelioid mesothelioma. This is reflected in figure 4. But high EZH2 expression had no impact on survival in biphasic and sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. So I think that the take-home point from this is if you would like to increase the sensitivity of your already available testing methods for differentiating mesothelioma and reactive mesothelial hyperplasia. Oh, I have a little typo there. You can consider implementing EZH2, but if you're just going to select one testing method, don't pick EZH2 because it's the worst as far as sensitivity. So that is pretty much my summary of this article. If anyone has any comments or questions.
Christine, thanks. Mm-hmm. Did they break this? I'm looking through the article and don't see it, but, you know, I'm just scanning. Did they list their results by type of mesothelioma?
No, and I really wanted to see that exact data, too. The only time that they broke down the different types of mesothelioma was in their survival curves, but I, too, was interested in that information, and they did not provide it.
Okay. Yeah, too bad. Okay.
Mm. Yeah, no.
I must say, we wanted to bring on EZH2 because there was a previous paper on it that also suggested that this would be helpful to distinguish reactive versus malignant. And it was, first of all, it was a little difficult to interpret the EZH2 because, as you pointed out in this article, they use a cutoff of 50%, but sometimes you have very weak staining in the nuclei, and mm-hmm. then it was difficult to decide whether that's negative or positive. And in the end, looking at our validation results, it didn't really help us that much, so we decided for now not to bring it on. We still have it on the back burner, but I remember that was a little difficult mm-hmm. to interpret.
We have MTAP, though, right?
We have MTAP, and that's fantastic, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was interested to see in the combinations on that table one how MTAP, BAP1, and FISH combo compared to the other sensitivities, and they didn't put that in there, but I was interested how that would have performed. So you are using MTAP.
We kind of use it instead of the FISH because FISH for us takes quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really nice to look this MTAP.
Yeah, it looks like, I mean, just so do you use MTAP in combination with BAP1 then?
Yeah.
Cool. Like I said, I'm unfamiliar with the staining, so that's interesting to learn. Yeah, the EZH2, when you look at this figure 3, it looks like the proportion of positive cells is all over the place, so I can imagine that would be difficult.
I believe that, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Interesting. Well, thank you. Anyone else? All right. I think we'll move on then to our next article, which is from a French group entitled SMARC4 Deficient Thoracic Sarcomas, Clinical Pathologic Study of 30 Cases with an Emphasis on Nosology and Differential Diagnoses. So the purpose of this work really there were two aims. The first was to describe the clinical pathologic features in, I believe this is the largest cohort to date of SMARC4 deficient thoracic sarcomas. And then they also wanted to assess the specificity of a predicted immunohistochemical signature that is co-loss of SMARC A4 and SMARC A2 and overexpression of SOX2. So, as already mentioned, there were 30 cases that were identified in this group, and the diagnoses were confirmed by two pathologists. Their diagnostic criteria was that the morphology was rhabdoid or poorly differentiated. There was loss of SMARC A4 and SMARC A2 expression by immunohistochemistry, and there was at least focal expression of two of the following markers, which are SOX2, CD34, and SAL4. So then they went on to look at the clinical information, demographics, and imaging for these patients. They also performed detailed immunohistochemical characterization of all of these tumors, and they scored this as negative, kind of a marginal and positive, as plus minus or positive. The stains they looked at, I've already mentioned the SMARC A4, the SMARC A2, SOX2, CD34, and SAL4, but they also looked at pancytokeratin, AE1, AE3, EMA, SMARC B1, CLDN4, TTF1, P63, P40, and NUT. This is all summarized in Table 2 if you wanted to take a look at those in detail. They also applied SMARC A4 to a screening group of 431 cases, which included a variety of carcinomas and sarcomas. And to this group, they applied either SMARC A2 or SOX2. It looked like just due to limited resources, they had to pick, they randomly picked either one stain or the other to apply to these groups. So 220 of those 431 cases underwent testing for SMARC A2 and 280 for SOX2. So looking at the clinical features of patients with SMARC A4 deficient thoracic sarcoma, they're really consistent with that which has been reported in previous studies. This is summarized in Table 1 if you want to look at that in the article. But I've included it here. So the patient characteristics are there's a male predominance of a ratio of 9-1. These tumors occurred in a broad age range from 28 to 90 years with a median age of 48 years. And the vast majority of patients were current or former smokers. The tumor characteristics, these are characterized as large compressive masses that in order of decreasing frequency involve the mediastinum, pleura, and lung. Many of the cases, however, were multifocal, though, and so they involved more or one of these sites. So while they said mediastinum was the most common site, perhaps this is the one that is the most frequently used, and then, most frequently involved. And then 77% of patients had metastases. They looked at the types of treatment that these patients received, and it was thought that despite varied treatment strategies, all patients suffered disease progression with poor overall survival, and really the treatments included surgery or radiation or chemotherapy. None seemed to work particularly well. Again, the pathologic features were in keeping with their diagnostic criteria and those previously described. That is sheets of discohesive pleomorphic epithelioid cells with rhabdoid features and abundant necrosis. They felt that they found novel findings in four of the cases, that it included two of the cases were described as reminiscent of desmoplastic small round cell tumor. This is in figure three if you wanted to take a look at how these areas looked. And then also two of the cases showed focally myxoid edematous stroma. Looking at their immunohistochemical workup, all cases of SMARC A4 deficient thoracic sarcoma showed loss of SMARC A4 and SMARC A2. Kind of this is by definition, however, for their diagnostic criteria. And 96% of cases showed staining for SOX2. So So out of the SOX2, CD34, and SOUL4, this was the best immunostain. I have a typo in this next. It's CD34 was seen in not 96, but 63% of cases, and SOUL4 was often negative. It was negative in 67% of cases. 54% of cases were positive for AE1, AE3. But if you look at staining overall positivity for epithelial markers, EMA, and AE1, AE3, 96% of cases were positive. One case represented a potential pitfall with focal staining for TTF1. Now, looking at their screening group, that's kind of summarized. If you've got the article out, that's on page 461. That's really in the body of the text. I would have appreciated a table, but I'm afraid there was none. So anyhow, I've summarized it as SMARCA4 was lost in a surprising number of screening group carcinomas, the largest group being large cell carcinoma, where SMARCA4 staining was absent in 21% of cases. It was also lost in sarcomatoid carcinomas, but perhaps you could argue that the spindly morphology, assuming that that's what it looked like, may not be as overlapping with SMARCA4 deficient thoracic sarcoma as you might think a large cell carcinoma might be. There was also loss of SMARCA4 and SMARCA2 in small cell carcinoma of the ovary hypercalcemic type, which is known to occur. And SOX2 was expressed in 37% of squamous cell carcinomas. So simply highlighting in this screening group that any one marker is not specific for SMARCA4 deficient thoracic sarcoma, and that you need to look at immunostains and in combination and in the setting of the clinical and histologic context. So for this case, I think that the take-home points are co-loss of SMARCA4 and SMARCA2 and expression of SOX2 by immunohistochemistry are helpful and specific for the diagnosis of SMARCA4 deficient thoracic sarcomas. And I thought that this was an interesting point buried in the discussion, that cases that show loss of SMARCA4 and express epithelial markers but do not fulfill the other diagnostic criteria detailed above are classified by these authors as SMARCA4 deficient carcinoma. So you can't just look at SMARCA4 and designate it as thoracic sarcoma. So anyhow, that's that article. If anyone has any comments or suggestions.
I'm trying to figure out how to apply that should a tumor come along that expresses an epithelial marker and is also TTF1 positive, the pitfall you outlined. I mean,
I know.
Which category should that actually live in, I wonder?
I likewise, they spent a long time in their discussion arguing how they feel that SMARCA4 deficient thoracic sarcomas aren't carcinomas. So your point is well taken. Anyhow, all right, we'll move on to the last article then, if no one has anything else. This is our final article is out of Mass General. This is was published in Histopathology, and as I already mentioned, this is not a strictly thoracic article or thoracic specimens, but I think this is a problem we encounter. This is the histologic diagnosis of IgG4-related disease on small biopsies, challenges, and pitfalls. So this group wished to assess the histologic spectrum of findings in small biopsies from a prospective series of patients with presumptive clinical diagnoses of IgG4-related disease to understand the relative importance of current pathologic criteria used for diagnosis, which, as they mention, is really this criteria was made based on resection specimens, and a lot of that you're not necessarily going to see in small biopsies. Also, a minor objective that they really used the retrospective and control groups appeared to be the validation of in situ hybridization for IgG and IgG4. I think this may have come as, although they don't specifically mention it, something that was unanticipated from this paper, because numerous times throughout the article they expressed frustration with their IgG and IgG4 immunostains. So so I think they ultimately decided to validate this, and they just published it in this paper. So looking at their methods, this is a prospective cohort comprised of 55 patients seen at Mass General Hospital who underwent needle or small biopsy. And the way they defined small biopsy was a biopsy that is less than 1 centimeter. The biopsies were from a variety of sites, kind of summarized in Table 2 if you want to look at those in detail. But the most common sites were from the retroperitoneum and salivary gland biopsies. Three biopsies were from the lung, if you're interested in knowing that. The clinical characteristics of these patients were evaluated and included tumefactive lesions. They looked at the number of organs involved and those that were described as involved. They also looked at the serum levels for IgG4, and they considered the response to immunosuppressive therapy. They performed both immunohistochemistry and in situ hybridization for IgG and IgG4 on the retrospective and control groups. The retrospective cohort was comprised of 71 resection specimens from patients diagnosed with IgG4-related disease, and their control cohort were those that are considered histologic mimics of IgG4-related disease. And those are detailed if you're looking at the article on page 692. So in the prospective study, 26 patients were categorized as definite IgG4-related disease on biopsy using the current diagnostic criteria. And I apologize, I hadn't mentioned that before, but if you wanted to look at that while I'm speaking, it's on table 1. So using the current diagnostic criteria, about half of patients, they could get to definite IgG4. In the other half, or a little bit more than half, 53% of patients, they categorized as borderline IgG4-related disease on biopsy. And that was really a combination of the clinical criteria had to be there. These patients needed to have a clinical suspicion of IgG4. As I already mentioned, this wasn't a random group that they selected from. But on biopsy, these patients were categorized as borderline IgG4 based on lack of one or more histologic criteria or immunohistochemical findings. So the most common cause that these patients were categorized as borderline was that 20 cases lacked both storiform fibrosis and obliterative phlebitis. And then 8 or 9 cases did not have enough IgG4 positive plasma cells. So they just didn't hit that sweet spot that varies for each organ system, 20 per high power field in the lung, but it's 100 per high power field in the salivary gland and lymph node. Interestingly, however, 99% of the patients in both definite and borderline groups showed IgG4 to IgG ratios of greater than 40%. So that the ratio was consistent between both groups. So they wanted to look at the clinical characteristics of those groups that they couldn't fully categorize as IgG4-related disease on biopsy and see how those patients differed, or if they did differ, from those with definite IgG4-related disease on biopsy. And that's really detailed in Table 3. But I think that the takeaways, at least for me from that table, are that the borderline group is slightly younger, not by much, but 48 years versus 53 years. The borderline cohort had higher peripheral and tissue eosinophilia. But importantly, there was no significant difference in organ involvement or serum IgG4 level between the two groups. Both groups responded to steroid or immunosuppressive therapy, although those that were defined as definite cases of IgG4 related disease had a better response, with 6% not responding as compared to 17% in the borderline group. So then looking at the IgG4, so looking at their retrospective and control groups, the data that came out from that was looking at the ratios. So once again, they decided that, as with previous studies, the cutoff of 40% for immunohistochemistry is sufficient to distinguish IgG4-related disease from its histologic mimics. When comparing that to in situ hybridization, they felt that a lower ratio is required to be deemed an acceptable threshold for differentiating IgG4-related disease from the histologic mimics. They felt like a cutoff of 30% was sufficient there. And if you want to look at that in more detail, that's on Figure 5. So in the last minutes, the take-home message is that IgG4 to IgG ratio is the most sensitive histologic feature in small biopsies from patients with a presumptive diagnosis of IgG4. And that patients with presumptive diagnosis of IgG4-related disease but lacking all the classic histologic features are clinically similar to those who fulfill the pathologic criteria. So from a clinical standpoint, perhaps these patients should be treated the same. So anyhow, I hope you found that article interesting. I did, and I would open the discussion up now to any comments.
Thanks, Christine. You know, it sounds like they had a pretty, I mean, they must have an IgG4 clinic or something. I don't know. I mean, again, talking about how you would apply this to the case where you get a needle biopsy of a lung mass with a lot of plasma cells, I guess this won't change very much what I do. I'll still suggest it because often they don't come with IgG4 serologies, et cetera, and we never find out, you know, what those are frequently. So I don't know how you plan on using this in your sort of consult practice.
I would say maybe not. The question seems to have come up more in our in-house cases, I feel like, where they've been extensively worked up and they're saying, are you sure this isn't IgG4? And we're like, well, we can't get there, but there are a lot of IgG4 plasma cells. So, no, I agree with you completely. And I think that they do have some type of treatment center here at Mass General looking into it, that's where these patients were taken from. So they certainly had a different type of practice setting than we do here or a consult practice.
Christine, Vish Pandey was one of the first authors on that consensus paper.
Mm-hmm.
They published it a few years ago, so he obviously has a lot of interest in this.
Yes.
But I will often, if I get a mass but there's no tumor but a lot of plasma cells, I'll always do IgG4.
Mm-hmm.
And I report if it's more than 40%, or I'll just describe it.
Right.
We've had about 4 or 5 cases in the last 5 years, I'd say, on lung biopsies that turn out to be IgG4-related masses when they go in and they do the lobectomy and take it out. And the other thing that's really interesting is sometimes there's a lot of eosinophils present.
Right.
Two of these patients have had asthma, and I wonder if it really is asthma. That's my question, because I think we're learning about IgG4, what it can do.
Right.
It's not just causing masses. I think it can, you know, it's the whole pathophysiology of this is very interesting.
Right, exactly. And I thought it was interesting that this borderline group had a lot more eosinophilia. So I wonder if that's kind of what you're alluding to.
Maybe it's just marking another syndrome as well.
Yep.
But the other thing is that, you know, IgG4 levels are not helpful in the serum. Because a lot of diseases can have IgG4 positive levels and they're not, it's not IgG4 related disease. So if it's positive or negative, it doesn't really make much difference. To me, I think the only usefulness is if it is positive, they can use it to monitor treatment.
They said that a number of these patients did not have, I mean, it was like a quarter, I think I would need to look back in the paper, but about a quarter of them have elevated serum IgG4.
Yeah.
But still clinically, they were labeled as IgG4-related disease.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
I think the problem with the definition in this case, and I think it does fit with our own rheumatologists who will often make those calls that you described, Christine, and when you say it doesn't make it histologically, you know, they often say, well, I think I'll treat them with steroids. And whatever you label something, if it's characterized by a lot of plasma cells and eosinophils, I suspect many of those patients will get better with steroids, which doesn't mean they have the same problem.
Right.
So I think the diagnostic criteria are still kind of a little bit squishy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think responding to steroids establishes a diagnosis.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot to learn about this whole syndrome.
Yeah, Jeff, that reminds me of the discussion years ago about acute eosinophilic pneumonia, that you describe a disease by its response to therapy, which is really not a good way to describe a disease.
Yeah. I just had a consultation case that was a classic CMV pneumonia. It was unambiguous. And then I got a call saying, you know, the clinician doubts it because the patient got better with steroids. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, but it doesn't mean that he didn't have CMV pneumonia.
Right.
Great. Yeah.
Thanks, Christine. Great job.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Christine.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.